Naturally speaking.
Okay, welcome to our second episode of Naturally Speaking. This is going to be our very first research-focused episode. I'm Sean Killen, and I'm here with two Jameses. Go ahead.
So I'm James Buckley.
I'm James Grecian.
And so in this episode, we're going to be focusing on some of the research going on in the Institute. I don't know, what are we going to call this segment? Research Roundtable?
Why not?
Why not? We could call it Why Not.
Spontaneous thinking is not a bit of a challenge.
If anyone has any good suggestions for things that we could call when we sit around and talk about research, please write in. Let us know. Send us a letter. Do either of you guys want to start off with some interesting research that you found going on recently?
Okay.
Me, James Buckley. We need to come up with nicknames to call you guys so people can know.
Rather than just like the Jameses.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, go ahead. So in the media recently, there's been quite a bit from the WWF, the Worldwide Fund for Nature.
Worldwide Wrestling Federation?
I don't think they've published a Living Planet report, 2012. But in this report, that published by the Worldwide Fund for Nature, they highlight basically the negative impacts of increased resource use and population growth on ecosystem health. And this is particularly focused on population declines of the numerous species they monitor across the world. So this links in quite neatly with a recent paper published in a journal, Molecular Ecology, by Claire Marsden, Sarah Cleveland, and Barbara Mabel. So they were looking at the African wild dog, which is endangered, and they were using basically blood and tissue samples to get DNA. They got DNA from blood and tissue samples from African wild dogs across South and East Africa. And
so why are the wild dogs endangered? What threats are they?
There's obviously a lot of problems with habitat fragmentation, habitat destruction, so that's sort of the people destroying habitats for growing crops and therefore breaking up the land into smaller and smaller patches. This research looked at patterns of genetic diversity, or genetic variation at particular markers, and these are sort of points across the genome. But using these genetic tools will allow you to explore how well these populations are doing, how well the existing populations are doing, how connected they are, how much flow there is between them. And it's often thought that population isolation and small population sizes can be pretty negative for the future persistence of a species.
Yeah.
They showed this with these genetic markers, using these genetic markers and genetic analysis sort of techniques. They sort of found significant structure and sort of subdivision among these populations. They found significant sort of isolation in conjunction with this, and also that the population sizes were particularly low. And interestingly, all these patterns do appear to be associated with the ongoing habitat destruction in these regions. So it therefore clearly highlights that this species, the African wild dog, is under significant threat, and significant work we needed to improve the connectivity of these populations and allow individuals to move between them to prevent these populations becoming isolated and vulnerable to random sort of environmental change.
Did they mention any ways you could actually do that? Increasing the connections between different populations.
It's essentially just making sure that more habitat is preserved and protected, but also making sure that habitat is connected, so you can join up areas which are particularly sort of isolated or particularly sort of like isolated from other groups.
Yeah,
because those are the ones most likely to be at risk. But just I think generally it highlights that genetic tools. These such genetic tools, such as using these genetic markers and various analysis, can assist in identifying perhaps areas which are areas within a species that are most in need of conservation.
I mean, so in some cases, you've got rhinos, severe other large mammals in Africa that are actually being like translocated around the country to try and increase gene flow. Is it the case, do you think, with African wild dogs that people are going to be going out and catching them and shifting them around? I mean, is that practical?
I suppose that translocations are quite widely thought of as a tool to assist in conservation. I'm not sure. It wasn't really mentioned in this paper.
Well, some species, there might be issues there with social structure, too. Introduce animals from a completely different group.
I think
might just kill them or something. I don't know for wild dogs, but
I imagine there's a significant amount of problems with essentially with moving things back and forth and all over the place and
taking territories.
It might not necessarily help, and it's probably not a sustainable way of trying to manage natural populations by continuously having to move things from A to B. It's better to try and connect them up via habitat.
Yeah.
Oh, very interesting.
Other James?
Other James.
There's a story about testicles.
Yeah, well, we always know that sex sells. And there's a great paper out by Michelle Bellingham in the International Journal of Andrology. And so they were looking at the potential impacts of environmental chemicals. There's been lots of previous work in this field looking at the potential impacts of environmental chemicals and how they may cause declining male reproductive health. And there's been stuff in the media about whether or not the reason that sperm counts are dropping at the moment is due to the amount of these environmental chemicals in the environment. Mm-hmm. So they looked at sheep in this study, and they looked at the potential developmental problems in the womb. So they were they had an experiment where they were covering the fields in sludge, in sewage.
Sounds lovely.
Apparently, it's quite common. but what that does is it kind of gives a good baseline of the amount of the amount of chemicals in human waste. So it's kind of, it's the levels that we're also exposed to in the environment.
So this study was, this is useful for the sheep too, because this is something they're exposed to all the time, but the sheep are also being used as a model for how these things might be affecting humans.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So there's been work that shows that these environmental chemicals can have problems with Sertoli cells, and these are the cells that are really key in gonad development.
Okay.
So the idea with the study was that by exposing ewes that were grazing on this pasture to these chemicals, they may then impact the developing embryos. So they looked at male sheep that were growing in these ewes, and looking at the effects over gestation. Then once the lambs were bred up to about 7 months, they then looked at the morphology of the testes to see if there'd been any impact.
Okay, and they found that there was.
Yeah, it looks like, although the thing they found that was quite interesting was that the actual size and hormone levels in our size of the testes and the hormone levels in the blood were similar between the control group that hadn't been exposed to this human waste and the lambs that had. The actual morphology of the testes was quite different, and so the suggestion is that they had spermatogenic abnormalities. So basically the sperm were quite different.
That sounds awful.
I don't want to be diagnosed with those. And the suggestion here is that low levels of environmental chemicals in the environment may actually cause problems that aren't necessarily highly visible. Okay. And could have long-term effects. And they draw parallels with long-term decrease in human sperm count.
So these chemicals are actually being ingested by the parents and then getting passed on to the offspring through the parents. So they're pretty persistent. That's pretty scary.
Yeah, there's long-term effects in certainly other work that's been done in the department looking at persistent organic pollutants suggests that the kind of chemicals that are now naturally in the environment and persist over long periods of time because of the fact that they're, you know, man-made plastics and things like that can cause quite a lot of problems.
Do they suggest any particular chemicals that might be problematic? I mean, is it more the artificial sort of, you know, the inorganic compounds that we produce and sort of manufacture that are likely to cause problems with the, or increase problems with reproduction?
And they've got a whole list of things from with names that you really don't want to have to produce or pronounce, but a whole load of benzenes and benzophylenes and
lots of enes and lots of benzoes,
so lots of just really, really nasty.
We'll be posting links to these papers on the Facebook page too, so you can follow along at home with our stumbling.
And if you want to kind of correct me on my pronunciation, feel free to phone in, write in to James Can't Pronounce Chemicals at Naturally Speaking.
But it does link in nicely with some of the sort of estrogen present in nature that's actually having a feminizing effect on organisms. So I suppose it links in with that sort of thing, that chemicals, artificial chemicals,
pollution. Gender benders.
Yeah.
It's interesting this side of it. It's very interesting this side of it.
Mm. And this story's got a lot of press coverage recently too.
Everybody's picked up on it. I mean, but the idea that persistent or long-term environmental chemicals having effects on sperm counts, it's always going to get massive, massive media coverage.
I was chatting with Neil Metcalf today at tea, and he was saying that he saw in The Scotsman, they'd reported on this story as men should use it as an excuse for why they don't have to wash up the dishes after dinner, because I guess one of the chemicals maybe comes from detergents, so they're suggesting that men say, oh, sorry, I can't do that because my testes will be impacted.
I think as long as they don't ingest it, they're probably okay.
I was thinking that could be a good excuse for people, or that would be a reason to want to do
that. You'd have to stop sucking on the bottle and downing.
Yes, I think it's really
down in washing up liquids probably
not
such a
great
idea.
If you make such a mess, so you end up ingesting it, and that might be a problem.
Yes.
So Sean, what about you? I think you've been looking through the literature.
Yes. Are you guys familiar with this whole issue with bovine tuberculosis in the UK? So yeah, as a foreigner, I wasn't so aware of this whole issue of bovine tuberculosis. This is an infectious disease which infects cattle, but it's an enormous problem in Great Britain. In 2008 and 2009 alone, the management of this disease, so including testing cattle and the cattle that died from this disease and ones that had to be destroyed, the cost of the industry were over almost £110 million. So that's quite a significant amount.
Is that through the culling of the cattle, or actually?
I'm not exactly sure.
I imagine there's a lot of culling of cattle as a control at the moment.
I think that's animals lost to either dying from the disease or culling. But I think there's costs involved in testing as well. Yeah. And I'm not sure exactly what the breakdown is. I never actually went into that in any of the things I looked at. But just overall, there's a huge cost here. This disease isn't a new thing. It's been around for almost a century. And in a lot of developed nations, it's been pretty much eradicated. But in some areas, it's complicated by the fact that the bacteria that causes TB can actually infect other animals as well, so not just the cattle. And in the UK in particular, one of the significant problems is that it can infect badgers. And so you have this disease that even if you eradicate it in the cattle populations, you have these reservoirs of wild badgers.
Lovely, cuddly badgers.
Yeah, that can reintroduce this disease to the cattle. Well, one of the things that's been suggested to control the spread of TB is to start culling or killing off badgers and thinning out their population. But as you say, this is obviously highly controversial because people generally love badgers. They think about things like wind in the willows.
Animals of farming wood.
Yes. Yeah.
Animals of farming wood.
Badger.
It's 1990s cut.
Everybody loves mashed potato. Bodger loves mashed potato. Sorry, carry on.
Who knew all of those badgers, like Mr. Badger and Wind of the Willows, he may have had bovine TB. He may have been spreading bovine tuberculosis.
Going around biting the ankles
of feces. Pus. to the cattle populations. But badgers have their own special legislation protecting them in the UK as well. And so, we have this, and it's under consideration right now. Should we be culling them? It is a big move, so we really need to know what we're doing. And in the 1990s, in 1998, there was a controlled trial where they actually tried some culling of badgers just to see how in local areas how that would affect bovine tuberculosis. I'm just going to say TB for now. And what they found is that the results were actually mixed. In some cases, it seemed to improve things. In some cases, it actually seemed to make things worse.
Were these two studies, one?
This was one main study in Great Britain, but at the same time, there was another study going on in in the Republic of Ireland, where they actually found that culling did have an effect on reducing the incidence of bovine TB. So why were these differences being found, these two different sets of trials in these two different countries? And so that's where these researchers came in. So Catherine O'Connor, Dan Hayden, Roland Cow on our department, in a paper in Preventive Veterinary Medicine, the journal, they compared these trials systematically to figure out, were these trials actually all that similar? They superficially look similar, but when they actually broke it down, they're actually quite different. So, for example, in Great Britain, you have differences in herd sizes compared to in Republic of Ireland. There's more badgers here as well, so you get all kinds of interesting differences in terms of more badgers that spread the disease, but also when you take out badgers, you have all these effects on social structure, which can have unpredictable effects on how the disease is spread. And then you throw in the human equation on top of that as well. In Great Britain, there was less compliance in actually culling the badgers.
So is there any hope? Is there any hope for controlling this disease?
No, it is incredibly complex. That's one of the things that the authors emphasize in the study, and that we really need to look at how these different subtle differences can actually add up to affect things. But just generally, it's interesting how it's a sort of mini ecosystem between cows, badgers, the bacteria, and humans. And so it's this really neat, they call it an episystem, how all these different factors interact.
Which I think it shows you generally, doesn't it, that you can rarely consider the effects of X on Y.
Yeah.
You have to consider the effects of X and Y with respect to all these other things that might also influence the system.
Definitely.
So it seems a very, very sensible conclusion.
And when you're proposing the culling of any species, but something like badgers especially, it's really important to understand how these different factors work. I felt really sort of proud of myself when I was reading through this paper because they talked about R-naughts. R0 values, and I just watched Contagion, so I knew what R0 meant. So,
what does it mean?
Should we be asking this?
Have you guys seen Contagion? R0 values is, so if an individual gets sick, it's the number of other individuals that they'll spread the disease to. So a disease with a high R0 value.
Is this the thing that Kate Winslet describes in Contagion? Yes. Like a nice long lecture.
They're worried that Gwyneth Paltrow, the disease that she has a high R0 value because they're worried it would spread rapidly. And so in the UK, or in Great Britain, the disease was showing signs of having a higher R0 value than the prevalence of TB in Republic of Ireland. So the British cows, I guess, are similar to Gwyneth Paltrow in that movie. Well, just in terms of their disease spreading ability.
So who's the Kate Winslet in the paper?
I don't know. Maybe that would be Cat O'Connor. I don't know. Or Dan Hayden. Maybe Roland. Roland, I think, is probably more Matt Damon, maybe. He was in that movie, too.
I haven't seen that film.
Photos of Roland from last week's episode are on the blog, so if you want to get in, we'll take a vote.
We'll do a side-by-side comparison. Anyway, so I think that's a good place to leave it there. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week or in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast, and you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.